Welcome to State of the Bay. I'm Grace Wan. Later this hour, Dr. Bryant Lin is a primary care physician and professor at Stanford Medical School, and he never imagined that one day he'd become a patient at the same school where he teaches. But diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer just before his 50th birthday, Lin is now sharing his journey from doctor to patient in a course for Stanford students. We talked to Lin, whose infectious and upbeat personality is helping him and his family cope with his condition. But first, anyone who's lived in San Francisco has navigated the stark reality of homelessness. It's not an issue unique to the city. An estimated 40,000 unhoused people live in the Bay Area, a staggering figure that speaks to the depth of the crisis. My guest tonight, longtime San Francisco Chronicle journalist and Pulitzer Prize nominee Kevin Fagan, has spent decades on the streets creating relationships with the unhoused and documenting their stories. In his new book, The Lost and the Found, A True Story of Homelessness, Found Family, and Second Chances, Fagan, who once experienced homelessness himself, weaves empathy and firsthand knowledge into a vivid account of two unhoused individuals, Rita and Tyson, and their families who helped them fight to reclaim their lives from the street. By passionately describing Rita and Tyson's struggles with addiction, Fagan challenges us to reflect on our own encounters with our unhoused neighbors, while emphasizing the urgent need for effective solutions in the battle against homelessness. So with all that, welcome back to State of the Bay, Kevin, and congratulations on your new book and on your retirement from the Chronicle.
Thanks, Grace.
Yeah.
I don't really feel retired yet. I'm pretty busy.
you do seem pretty busy. The book is very popular. And for State of the Bay listeners, this is your chance to talk to a real expert who's been right on the sidewalks collecting these stories. We're going to open up our phone lines early tonight to hear from you. Have you or someone else close to you ever had to navigate the challenges of finding stable housing and fighting addiction? What resources or support systems were most helpful and during that time? And what would you like to see local governments, Daniel Lurie, our mayor, do to address the problems facing the chronically unhoused? Give us a call. We're at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Or send us a message on X at State of Bay, or email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. So, Kevin, you have been covering this for chronically unhoused for a really long time. And, you know, you start out your book talking about your own story and the ways in which you felt both a connection and compassion for those living on the street. Tell us a little bit about why these stories were important for you to tell.
Well, I've been covering homelessness and poverty for a lot of years. I was tossed out of my house when I was 16, so I was on my own, slept in a field for a little bit, then an unfinished garage, and then as I was going through school, I spent times living in my car. So I had a feeling for what it was like, plus we were poor for a lot of my childhood. And then when I got out of school, I was a traveling street musician sleeping in doorways and you know, long roadways and in between towns in Europe and overseas, other places. It became familiar to me. So when I started a daily journalism career, talking to homeless people wasn't some anthropological expedition. It was just what I knew. And I covered crime and, you know, a whole panoply of things that you do as a daily reporter. But I came to specialize in you know, extreme crime, disaster, and homelessness. And homelessness was the thing I cared and have always cared most about. So when it came time for me to try something else, because when I retired in this January, I wanted another challenge. And this was doing this book. I loved writing it. It was actually kind of easy to write because it was just like writing a long news story. You just keep typing. And I loved the people I dealt with. I mean, Rita and Tyson's families were just lovely people, really inspiring.
Well, that comes through in the book. And just to step back, I mean, in 2003, you had a great editor, one who really understood what it takes to do deep coverage. And you and your colleague was it Rick Brandt?
Brandt Ward.
Brandt Ward took 6 months to just spend time learning about the communities in the city who were living unhoused. And, you know, and I mean, this is 21 years ago, 22 years ago now. It doesn't seem so different as you've described it. But tell me about that, going, finding these communities and the ability to actually ingratiate yourself and embed yourself in the communities in a way that people would open up to you.
Yeah, Brandt's a great photographer. We were partners for like more than 10 years on homelessness. And we got first hooked up together by Robert Rosenthal, this great editor we had in 2003, who said, send a couple of people out to figure out why there's so many homeless people, which was terrific. He said, take as long as you want. And Brandt and I always kind of worked fast, so we figured we didn't want to spend a whole year out on the street. But so we spent 6 months sleeping out a lot, going home a lot. We didn't pretend we were homeless, but, you know, we're kind of, what's the word, street guys, street reporters, street photographers. So, yeah, I've dressed the same way, you know, since I was a street singer. So I kind of fit in.
You fit in, yeah.
Yeah, and I loved talking to these folks. We went to the Golden Gate Park, the Bayview waterfront, downtown Tenderloin Mission, and we wound up spending a lot of time at this triangle of concrete called Homeless Island by the folks who were living there, about a dozen chronically homeless people addicted to, well, back then heroin. This is before fentanyl, but, you know, heroin was awful. Mm-hmm. Still is. Mm-hmm. Heroin and crack, meth. Meth had made its way into the world. Booze. And we're just subsistence living on the concrete with carts and tarps and cardboard. And the characters that they were just fascinating to us. And as a writer, it's you know, you should be able to write about anything. Mm-hmm. But these were particularly rich characters in terms of their backgrounds and their narratives, and Rita was one.
Right.
She had been a Golden Girl surfer girl in the '60s, an Olympics-bound gymnast, homecoming queen they called her. She was a runner-up, but she might as well have won because she was absolutely beautiful, and through a series of, you know, bad choices, bad luck, the usual, you know, rattling down the ladder of life that happens to chronically homeless people. She wound up in the street, addicted to heroin and crack, and living with sleeping alongside a guy named Tommy, who was the leader of this little group. Because what they would do was they would support each other with food and watching out for each other, and then they'd panhandle the traffic at Van Ness and Mission Streets, which is massive traffic with four-way stoplights. So great opportunity. Go wade out into the traffic and panhandle. Some of these folks had only one leg, which was, you know, elicit sympathy. Some of them, like Rita and Tommy, had good smiles, nice manners. And so it was a good place to get your money.
I mean, I know exactly the island that you're talking about. And I mean, was it Tommy that had the perfect sign that got everybody's attention? Tell us what it said.
I think it was "Anything helps, even a smile."
Yes.
I think was his sign.
Yes. I think that you wrote that he took that sign, that slogan, across America and did real well with it.
He did. Yeah. He did. And he had he was a nice appearing guy. He exuded niceness.
Yeah.
Which, you know, worked really well. When you're panhandling, you're being a salesperson. You know, you got to sell yourself.
Yeah.
And you got to sell the act.
Well, you were saying, I mean, Rita was this golden girl. She came from Florida, and through a series of bad choices, she came to, you know, this triangle of concrete in San Francisco. What is it about Rita? I mean, there are a lot of people on this strip, and they were, as you described it, you know, a one-legged person, somebody who is very small, very petite. The first time you saw her, she was called Little Bit. You thought she was a child, and you were actually quite worried about her. But then there's this character, Rita. So tell, for listeners who haven't had a chance to read your book yet, which I recommend picking up at an independent bookstore, what was it about Rita's, you know, charisma? Because she didn't look like a beauty queen when you first met her.
No, she looked awful, and she knew it, and she was embarrassed because she knew what it was like to look great. And she, the street had wasted her out. She had wrinkles. She had hepatitis C, AIDS, giant abscesses crawling up her back that were going to kill her. In fact, an abscess came along and killed Tommy. He used to have an abscess on his leg, near his ankle, that was so deep that when he'd wake up in the morning, I mean, I'd be sleeping alongside him in a blanket, and he'd have to peel the tongue of his shoe out of it like Velcro.
Oh, and I mean,
and then he'd shoot straight into a vein in there, in the raw meat.
Wow.
And that got flesh-eating disease. It got out of hand. It ate him alive, essentially rotted him to death. It was terrible, terrible way to die. Brant and I went and found his body, told the Islanders, and Rita was devastated. I think that was kind of a last straw for her, because when her family read my story back east, she had a friend who passed it on to Pam, her sister, who passed it on to her daughters and her sons. And so Pam and Rita's daughter Joy flew out after they read that story. They said, "Oh Jesus, maybe we should go out there and do something," because they'd tried before. But there was something about the quality of that narrative that let them know that maybe she was ready to give it a try. And she was. She was what street counselors call cooked. She knew her health was more than in the dumper. Tommy just died. She didn't have a protector anymore, and she was ready to take the help. Mm-hmm. And what made the difference for her, I mean, the government help can really be huge for people. It helped a little bit. It got a little bit off the street eventually. But for Rita, it was the love of family that did it. They took her home. She got on all the kind of assistance she needed to, Medicaid,
She had disability.
Disability, right. Programs that helped her get rehab, and she enrolled in NA. She did the right things, and she had the right support with loving, stable family. And man, she straightened out quickly in a matter of months, and was on her way. It was pretty terrific to see. I waited a year to see if it would stick. Then I went back, and sure enough, she was doing great.
I mean, that was the thing in your book, how you were so hopeful that she would make it out and be successful, because I think you had seen before where sometimes it worked and sometimes it didn't work. And we'll talk a little bit more about that after this break. But, I mean, you mentioned this thing called cooked. I mean, this idea that the help comes and the people take the help when they are done.
Yeah. Yeah, they realize, they get tired. A lot of people get into their late 30s, 40s, certainly 50s. Rita was in her early 50s. And I know this from experience. The sidewalk gets really hard to sleep on. Mm-hmm. You know, there are no REI sleep mats out there. You're on cardboard or whatever, blankets you can pull together, which usually gets stolen or cleared away by street cleaners. It's just day after day of subsistence, and it wears on you. And and the chronically homeless have been out there for more than a year. Mm-hmm. And they're only about 30% of the homeless population, really. The rest are in shelters and stuff.
Right. Well, we're going to take a quick break. This is State of the Bay on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW Bay Area. I'm Grace Wan. Tonight, we're talking with Pulitzer-nominated journalist Kevin Fagan about his new book, The Lost and the Found, A True Story of Homelessness, Found Family, and Second Chances. We're hearing from you. Have you had encounters with the unhoused that have impacted your perspective on homelessness in a city that's known for both immense wealth and visible poverty? Where do you think the responsibility lies for addressing homelessness? Give us a call at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. More after this break.
Join us for Your Legal Rights Wednesday evenings at 6. Host Jeff Hayden and guests cover a wide variety of legal topics and issues, from tax tips to landlord-tenant issues, discrimination and workers' rights on the job, as well as broader constitutional issues. That's Your Legal Rights every Wednesday evening at 6, here on 91.7 KALW San Francisco Bay Area, and online at kalw.org.
Hello, I'm Dr. Emily Silverman from The Nocturnists. a Bay Area-based medical storytelling podcast that features personal stories from frontline clinicians, conversations with healthcare experts, and special documentary series like Post-Row America, hosted by Dr. Ali Block. We'll be sharing episodes from that series all week on Bay Made at 11:30 a.m. right here on KALW.org and 91.7 FM San Francisco Bay Area.
Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Grace Wan. I've been talking with Kevin Fagan. He is a former journalist with San Francisco Chronicle, and he has a new book. It's called The Lost and the Found, A True Story of Homelessness, Found Family, and Second Chances. It's about his interactions with two particular chronically unhoused individuals, Rita and Tyson, and some of the challenges facing the cities in which they were housed and the families who tried to get them back from the streets. We'd love to hear from you. Have you had encounters with unhoused people, and how has that impacted your view on homelessness? You can give us a call at 798-8255. That's 866-798-8255, or email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. Before the break, Kevin, we were talking about Rita, and she's part of your book. The other part of your book focuses on the story of Tyson, who grew up in Danville, had by all means a very stable, nice life, economically at least. But he ends up on the streets. And how did Tyson get there?
Well, I think he had a bipolar condition that was undiagnosed. And his family struggled to help him over the years. He was a popular kid in high school, you know, good time Charlie kind of guy, sailed through his studies, was smart, but he couldn't stick to long enough in college to finish it, couldn't stick to a job long enough to establish a career, got into cocaine and, you know, smoking dope. And he had these periods where he would, you know, he was a performer in a theater in Oakland, and he was pretty good. But one thing led to another. The places he couldn't hold a job, and he was living with his grandmother. Grandmother passed away. He bang, 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 again down the ladder of life, and he wound up in the street. Mm-hmm. And then he, you know, if you're not addicted to something when you wind up in the street, after a year or more of really brutal subsistence living, you often wind up addicted to something. And he wound up on heroin and meth, and eventually, of course, fentanyl.
Yeah.
So
this story in 2003, you did this profile, and then at some point, you know, his brother, who has moved to Ohio, sees the news account of Tyson's life. And I remember this, reading this in the Chronicle as you were writing it. I mean, his brother asks you for help, like, please help me find Tyson. And, you know, you write, you're kind of sometimes reluctant to do that for people. But you, in this case, you said, yeah, I'm going to help you. And you did help find Tyson for his brother, right?
Yeah, you got to pick your spots. This was actually 2019. I did a story where it was a story about a proposed shelter. And I interviewed Tyson. He was sitting on the sidewalk. Jessica Christian, this great photographer, was with me. Brand had retired by then. And Jessica shot this great photo. It ran, and then his brother Baron, who lives in Ohio, wound up reading this story and seeing the picture, and he calls me and says, I'm coming out there, can you help me? And I said, fine. I mean, he sounded like a really great guy. And you don't have to be a great guy for me to want to help find people. I get asked that a lot. But, you know, I have a job to do, so I can't spend all my time doing that. But he flew out here. I didn't know if there'd be a story in it or not, but it was the right thing to do. So we walked around all day, and sure enough, you know, I knew some camps to go to and crowds to ask. And Baron and this interventionist, Vicky, that he had with him, he hired to try to get Tyson into rehab. We found him, did an intervention in a hotel, and I participated. I mean, Baron and Vicky did the intervention, but my role as a reporter at this point in my career is not to just stand by and take notes. I would, when I was talking with Tyson, I'd say, look, man, this is your chance. Choose life. Take it. You don't want to live like that, do you? And he was ready. He was ready. He took the lifeline.
I mean, he was the one who said, you know, like you were talking, we were talking about how you're cooked, you know, you kind of reach the bottom. Mm. And he had said, you know, bottom is a relative position, right? Because, I mean, you feel like you hit bottom and then there's another bottom and another, but there was something there. So he goes, Tyson does go to Ohio. He goes first to rehab in Sierra Nevadas, then into this wonderful rehab in Mississippi. And I mean, before we get into Tyson's story, and I don't want to give away too much, but one thing that you've said in reflecting on all the work that you've done is, and I'm sure people ask you all the time, like, what should we do? And you've said supportive housing is critical. Tell us, for people, I mean, who may have heard that phrase but may not understand that phrase, why is supportive housing the answer?
Well, first off, the real answer is eliminating poverty.
You know,
30% poverty in this country. It's, if you count demographics and geographics, it's 30% is right at or below poverty. That fuels homelessness. And so once people have tumbled into the street and been there long enough to have really become dug in, they need the most help to come off. And that's the chronically homeless. And supportive housing is where you take someone like Tyson, or I'll use Little Bit as an example again, Little Bit, pull her up inside, do street counseling, and then pull her into a place to live, a roof, a door, and then have counselors on site, preferably and ideally a health clinic and an office of therapists and case managers on site who can help the people who move inside get over all the stuff that put them in the street to begin with. A job problem, mental problem, drug problem, whatever it is that hobbled you and then threw you into the street. And for a little bit, it worked. She moved inside finally, and she had great counselors who got her off heroin and crack and got her interested in art. I mean, it was just wonderful. And it's expecting someone to move into a housing unit by themselves if they've been chronic and they have those kind of disabilities of either addiction or mental disability is ridiculous. You're not going to get much success if at all by just giving someone a place to live. They need support to help them through. And that's what we do in most big cities. It's really grown. The series I did in 2003, Shame of the City, was a 5-day series. And in the last day, I said supportive housing is the most effective thing that Brant and I have seen. And it wasn't a first person thing. I showed examples of why it was an effective approach. And it is an effective approach. The trouble is we don't have enough of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the city, where could you find supportive housing? I mean,
you encounter any of a half a dozen outreach teams of counselors, street counselors who go out and talk to homeless people and say, hey, we can get you into shelter and then supportive housing or, you know, affordable housing if you are not in great need of this kind of counseling help. It's that just contact one of those teams, go to what they call an access point, essentially go online or have someone go online to find the Department of Homelessness and Supportive Housing. Mm-hmm. They will route you. They need more of the resource, but they do have resources. And you know, at the Chronicle and other places, we always periodically do stories about how they need more case managers or the buildings are run down, many of the buildings, that is. But all that having been said, there is terrific supportive housing in San Francisco and in just about every major city you can think of.
It's nice to hear that it exists as a possibility here. I want to take a couple of comments. This listener writes, walking down the street, I'm ashamed to say I often don't offer help to the people who are panhandling. It was my kids who reminded me that I needed to. But reading your reporting, I learned that the money is often used for drugs. Should I give money, food, gift cards?
Boy, that's a tough one. A lot of times it is used for booze or drugs. Sometimes It's used for food. I generally don't give out food. I mean money. I'll give food. Mm-hmm. Food is good. Food is actually pretty plentiful. If you're panhandling, kind people come by. It is a kind city, Jays, and that's that's one reason so many of us like to be there. So, give food. Sure, gift cards can be good. But what I find is most helpful is just stopping and talking. Let someone be seen for a few minutes. Mm. Give them the dignity of a conversation with someone who's housed and looks like they got their stuff together. Don't just pass by and either look sad or disgusted or indifferent. Notice them. Give them the dignity of your time and conversation. Because all those people are actually very fun to talk to. I mean, it's, you know, I love it. They got good jokes.
Right. Right.
You know, real life issues they can talk about. They read books. I mean, they're people like us.
They're people. I think it was Tyson who said this, like one of the hardest parts of being on the streets was the fact that people didn't make eye contact with him, that he felt invisible. And I can very much see how that happens, because as a person who lives in the city or in any place where there are unhoused people, you do get a little bit, unfortunately, kind of jaded about the conditions that people are living in, which they should not be living in. This is a very wealthy country. No one should have to live like that. So I think what you're saying is if you can't give a gift card, if you can't give food, at least give a little bit of eye contact and a hello and some compassion.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause the bottom line is no one really wants to be homeless.
Yes.
You get stuck in your survival mode. And sometimes if you have a conversation, they'll say, well, I have to be free out here. You have to be free because that's the survival method that you've learned. Give someone a stable roof and a chance at stable life, and they will take it.
What do you think about, I feel like this city has cycled through so many ideas, cash not care, jail time for drug addiction. I was fascinated to hear that the tents that have appeared all over through the city are really from the Occupy movement.
Yeah.
I had not made that connection, but I was like, wow, okay, yeah. Your first piece was, your first year was 2003. You've been covering this for a really long time. I think maybe steps have made that have gone forward, but in some ways people might say, oh gosh, it's not that different than in 2003. So what do you think, besides alleviating poverty, do we need to build more supportive housing? Do we need more shelter beds? I mean, Daniel Lurie had promised 1,600 new shelter beds within 6 months of his becoming mayor. I don't think that's going to happen. But what is the Kevin Fagan, thought here?
Yeah, I've actually written I've had some great editors at the Chronicle, and they had me write a couple of packages over the years, actually more than a couple, on what it would take to solve the problem. It's always a moving target. Even cities that came close to or did really good jobs at addressing their chronic homelessness, like Salt Lake City, you got to stay ahead of it or it gets away from you again. I need more supportive housing. I think Dan Lurie has the right idea of creating more shelter and more supportive housing. London Breed actually doubled the number of shelter beds, and she created more supportive housing than anyone since Newsom. The trouble is that for every one person who gets housed in San Francisco, four more take their place. Mm. So you're bailing out an endlessly refilling bathtub, and that's hard. In 2003, when Brant and I were doing our thing on the streets for 6 months, the one night point in time count, as they call it, of homeless people was about 8,600. This last one we had was 8,300. So actually there were slightly more people on the street then. But what you don't see is the tens of thousands of people who've been either given tickets home through Homeward Bound or housed, or rehabbed enough to be housed independently. Mm-hmm. So supportive housing, going home. It's you would have thousands upon thousands of more people if we didn't do the efforts we did.
What do you think about during the pandemic, the idea of Project Room Key, which is, you know, unoccupied rooms in motels were being used to house the homeless or unhoused. Was that a good program? Successful? Should it be replicated?
I thought it was a great program. The problem was, again, enough oversight, because, you know, you're always going to get people who don't behave well, and some people cause damage in the hotels, you know, a lot of damage, mm-hmm. expensive damage. And I know some of the counselors who were visiting them and trying to keep people on track. It was a tough job. You know, chronically, people can be troubled enough to, you know, be a pain in the ass in the hotel. They mm-hmm. break mm-hmm. things, they yell, you know. But not all of them. I mean, a lot of people were just fine and so grateful for the rooms. Mm. It showed how if we could create enough housing, and then of course create enough case managers to really keep a lid on it and interact and help people, it's effective. Mm. That's the main problem that I've seen over the years. And good God, I've done, Brent and I did stories on this back, geez, in the early thousands. Mm-hmm. Not enough case managers to help people.
Right. Well, let me take another question from a listener who writes, I have mixed feelings about all this. I'm sorry that people have been reduced to being unhoused. This cannot be good for them. But I also feel we have a right to navigate sidewalks and streets without having to walk through trash and human feces. Is this the price of living in the city or the price of our poor public policy choices? I mean, I think that gets to, you know, a bit of people are compassionate and then they have compassion fatigue.
Yes.
And, you know, and how has compassion fatigue sort of hindered our ability to get to real solutions from where you stand?
It comes and goes. I mean, we had it in the early 90s after a big paroxysm of efforts in the 80s. Then we had it again in the early 2000s. And now we're in another pretty dug in compassion fatigue period, because the governor put a lot of money into addressing this problem. The city doubled the money that it was spending on the problem, and the problem hasn't gone away. So people look at that and they say, okay, screw it. Get people off the streets any way you can. Well, you know, that's it. Just jailing everyone doesn't work, because you come out of jail and you're right back where you were, mostly. And just sweeping them puts the problem to another neighborhood. So it's continually trying to do the right thing. Meanwhile, even homeless people don't like having trash and garbage to have to walk through. But when you're, you know, chronically unhoused and stuck on the streets, you know, garbage, bad behavior, sure. It's mm-hmm. I get it. I no one wants that.
Right.
But how to get around it? Hey, God, the people who are trying to work on that through the city and the nonprofits, they're frustrated. They don't, and even the cops, they don't like sweeping people. Mm-hmm. It's not fun for anyone. Cops didn't get into law enforcement to do that. They got in there to bust bad guys. Mm-hmm. It's not like they're all just, you know, meanies trying to, you know, do bad things to homeless people. It's a real conundrum that it just doesn't get solved quick.
Well, I think your book helps address some of the compassion fatigue by putting stories to the faces and the names of the people we see. And before we leave, you did mention in the book and in our interview that you are a busker. You are someone who has sung for a living besides being an excellent reporter. And I was wondering if you could sing us out with a song that you often sing, I think, that you end your book performances with. And tell us the name of the song again.
Sure. I'll unplug the headphones so you can hear me when I strum.
Okay. That's great. That's great. And for our listeners, you've been listening to Kevin Fagan. He's a former San Francisco Chronicle journalist. He has a new book that's called The Lost and the Found, A True Story of Homelessness, Found Family, and Second Chances. You've been listening to me, Grace Wan. We're going to have a little bit more State of the Bay after Kevin's song. But Kevin Fagan, take us out.
Thanks. This song was written a long time ago, and I learned it in the street, and it still applies today.
I was walking by the graveyard late last Friday night. I heard somebody fell and it sounded like a fight. It was just a drunken hobo dancing circles in the night, pouring whiskey on the headstones in the blue moonlight. Where these homeless brothers go down in some hidden valley where their sorrows cannot show, where the police cannot find them, where the wanted man can go. There's freedom when you're walking, even though you're walking slow. Smash your bottle and stone and live while you can. That homeless brother is my friend.
Thank you so much, Kevin Fagan. And that was Kevin Fagan. He has got a new book, again, Lost and Found, The Lost and Found, A True Story of Homelessness, Found Family, and Second Chances. Everyone, pick up that book at an independent bookstore. Thanks again, Kevin. Okay, take care. More State of the Bay after the break.
This is Ethan Elkind on the next Your Calls One Planet series. Harvard University anthropologist Susan Greenhall joins us to discuss her new book, Soda Science, Making the World Safe for Coca-Cola. Greenhall details how Coke and other giant corporations secretly funneled millions of dollars into manipulating the public's trust in science to accomplish that goal, both in the U.S. and abroad. Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Ethan Elkind, and you.
That will be a rebroadcast of this morning's Your Call. That'll take place this evening at 7 o'clock on 91.7 FM KALW.
Dr. Bryant Lin is a primary care physician at Stanford Medical Center. He is also an oncology patient there. When given the sobering diagnosis of stage 4 lung cancer, Dr. Lin used his unique perspective to create a 10-week course for Stanford students called From Diagnosis to Dialogue, A Doctor's Real-Time Battle with Cancer. Here to share his wisdom and experience is Dr. Bryant Lin. Welcome to State of the Bay, Bryant.
Thanks for having me.
So first, I'm very sorry to hear about your diagnosis, and I wondered, how did you come to suspect that you had lung cancer?
Yeah, last spring, almost a year ago now, I started to have a cough and long history of allergies. So I thought it was just allergies. You know, sometimes we're cooking stuff and the smoke would irritate me. Luckily, I'm in primary care and my primary care doctor sits like two chairs down from me. So I could bug him for different treatments. So, you know, we tried different inhalers, eventually antibiotics. And when nothing helped, we finally got an x-ray, which showed a big white patch in opacity, which is, you know, code word for mass or other stuff on my right lung. Fortunately, you know, due to my, you know, excellent care at Stanford, I got quickly diagnosed. I had a CT scan the next day. I had a bronchoscopy, where they did a biopsy 2 days later. And then by that following Monday, so 6 days later, I had a tissue diagnosis of lung cancer.
I mean, traditionally, we associate lung cancer with smoking. You were not a smoker. Tell us a little bit about what's going on there. Is this a common occurrence for people who don't smoke?
Yes, absolutely. So, you know, first of all, lung cancer is the number one cause of cancer-related death in the world and in this country. Also, out of all the people who get lung cancer, roughly 20% are non-smokers or never smokers. I am one of those. I've never puffed. I've never smoked in my life or a moment in my life. And in terms of, you know, who gets never smoker lung cancer, you know, Asian people, especially Asian women, are at higher risk. Of course, I'm an Asian man. We don't really know why this affects Asians differently than other people. I have a tumor. My tumor has a mutation called EGFR, epidermal growth factor receptor mutation. And these are also, this type of mutation is very common among Asians. About 50% of Asians with lung cancer who are never smokers have this mutation, whereas in a non-Hispanic white group, it's under 20% have this type of tumor mutation. So, you know, why this happens, we don't know. We do know probably family history is a big driver. There's lots of theories out there about cooking oil, smoke from cooking, secondhand smoke, ventilation. But we really don't have anything definitive of why non-smokers get lung cancer yet.
When we think about treatment for a cancer like this, have there been strides in how it's approached? Is it generally chemotherapy, radiation?
Yeah, first of all, big caveat to all those people who have been diagnosed, a lot of treatment is very customized to your specific case. So take what I'm saying as more of a generalization. Earliest stage is mostly treated with surgery. Late stage, so just going to give you the opposite end, is mostly treated with something called systemic therapy. So there are two varieties of systemic therapy. One of them is chemotherapy, but also now we have targeted therapy. So this is where we've made great strides. And this is the area of what we call precision medicine, where people look at the tumor, in this case, my tumor, which has this tumor mutation. And because I have this tumor mutation, I am a candidate to take a targeted therapy called Tagrisso. The generic name is osimertinib. And so this is an amazing stride. This has been developed over years, and we've gotten more and more evidence that this should be used first line for advanced stage lung cancers. When I was in medical school, 27 years ago, when we heard about a stage 4 lung cancer patient, they didn't look like me. I have quality of life now. My lung cancer is there, but not progressing. I can do most of what I want to do, which is, a huge difference. So in long answer to your question, our ability to treat lung cancer has really radically changed over the last decade. And this is a tribute to our great advances in science and medication therapy.
Mm. We were talking earlier about the incidence of lung cancer among Asian women. And you have a special interest in how lung cancer disproportionately affects Asian populations because of your work. Tell us about the Center for Asian Health Research, which you co-founded at Stanford Medical School.
Yes, with my colleague, Dr. Latha Palaniappan, I co-founded the Center for Asian Health Research and Education about 6.5, almost 7 years ago. And, this was out of a realization that there's so many problems, so many diseases, medical problems that affect Asian populations differently. And, luckily we have many experts at Stanford who are working on these issues, but we really needed a way to bring everybody together, but also to raise resources and to offer common resources for this group, as well as raise funds for research and awareness. So not only lung cancer and never smokers, but normal weight diabetes, heart disease affects South Asians prematurely compared to non-Hispanic white populations. Nasopharyngeal cancer, so nose and throat cancer, can affect Chinese populations, as well as stomach cancer can affect East Asian populations. And, there's many more issues that impact Asians differently. And that's just on a disease basis. When you talk about immigrants and access to care and, limited English proficiency populations, there's also a whole host of other issues. Stanford is really the right place for this because As many of you may know or may not know, the Bay Area is 1/3 Asian. Yeah. Almost every county is about 1/3 Asian. Some are a little bit more than others. Of course, the world is 60% Asian. Mm-hmm. But in the United States, Stanford provides a unique opportunity to really study this and to raise awareness for diseases that impact Asians.
Well, as somebody who studies medicine, but also practices medicine, and now as a patient at your own hospital, how has having lung cancer changed your practice and your relationship with your patients in terms of what you're doing today versus, a few years ago?
Yeah, I would say the biggest way it's impacted my practice is more on the area of hope. So, I've always been a big believer in human-centered medicine, looking at the whole person, not just as a disease or a patient, but as a human being. In a role as a physician, you have to know, numbers and statistics. But in my case, I've learned that, the numbers don't look good. They don't sound good. But you need to have awareness of the numbers, a realistic hope. But you need to maintain that hope and optimism because it's really hard to live day to day as somebody with a serious illness where you're faced with numbers and not hope. So I think being a patient has made me really rebalance my approach to patients and discussing statistics, but really making sure that they understand that there is some hope in the future. And for myself personally, you know, my hope is in new technology. So there's always hope. And, you know, it's really hard to live day to day without that hope. So I think being impatient has really made me very acutely aware of the importance of hope.
A lot of people, when they receive a diagnosis like this, I mean, there's just a myriad of reactions. Some people want to keep it private. Some people are happy to talk about it. I mean, what led you to not only talk publicly about your diagnosis, but then to want to teach a class about it?
Yeah, or it's funny. I looked through my emails about, you know, when was the first time I thought about teaching this class? Actually, I was diagnosed in May and I sent my first email in June about this. So pretty much, you know, very soon afterwards. And, you know, I always have this approach to life generally of making, you know, turning lemons into lemonade, right? Mm. Taking something that's unfortunate and negative and turning into positive. My colleague, Dr. Paula Naupan, heard this phrase the other day, which may be more appropriate, is turning crap into fertilizer. So maybe that's a better way to say it. And, you know, I'm in this unique position as, you know, one of the leaders of our Center for Asian Health. So part of my responsibility and job is to raise awareness. And, you know, I was, again, very conscious that now that I have the opportunity to really use my story as a way to raise awareness and hopefully more resources and so forth toward lung cancer and never smokers, in particular in Asians. But I'm also aware as an educator that this is such a teaching opportunity. It's such a, you know, amazing teaching opportunity. At least from my perspective is, you know, if I were a student, what would I have wanted heard? I would have loved to hear from somebody who has both perspectives. And that's what I was hoping to provide. And hopefully I did provide that.
Well, your class was available to Stanford medical students as well as undergraduates. And I'm just curious, what was the structure? Was it all about your diagnosis? Was it about patient care?
Yeah, when we designed the class, we really wanted to rebalance it so that the class really more or better reflected the experience of the patient. So rather than, you know, purely focusing on, you know, disease, diagnosis, treatment, and, you know, all the medical science and medical care, we also had about half our sessions really on the human side on what the patient deals with. So we had a panel on caregiving. My wife was one of the panelists. We had a panel on spiritual care. So we had four people from different religions talk about their approach to people, to death and to serious illness. We had a panel from our chief medical officer on access to medical care, which is, you know, how do you access care? How do you get the care you need? And then, you know, another panel on mental health and stories in around cancer. And as well as associated with the class, we had a whole kind of cancer storytelling session on a weekend to really talk about how patient stories are so important. So that was a big approach. Every session really started out with my story or an update on what was going on with me or my perspectives on the topic of the day. And then we would have, you know, the outside speaker or panel talk and then have a discussion afterwards. So that was the general format. Really, I was a case study for this discussion about a broader topic. We hope to rebalance it and also, again, provide a face to the disease, to the problem.
Well, you mentioned that your wife came in to speak about the role of a caregiver. I'm sure your diagnosis has had such a tremendous impact on your family. And I wondered, were there any things that your wife shared that you were surprised to hear?
I've been so fortunate. My wife is really a rock to me and has been a constant source of support and strength for me. No, nothing. I wouldn't say she said anything surprising. I think I was surprised by the students' response and how they found it so valuable to hear from my wife and other caregivers and to get their perspectives. So I was quite surprised and pleased that they found that session quite impactful. And part of that, I think, is because a lot of them have been caregivers. Caregiving is you know, quite challenging, right? There's a lot of caregiver burnout, can be very isolating and lonely experience. So, you know, sharing our stories can really help support each other.
I think what part of what is very compelling about your story, beyond teaching a class about your own diagnosis, is that your attitude is just very upbeat, very positive. And, you know, you've literally called yourself the luckiest man on the earth. And can you unpack that? I mean, I don't think that's what a lot of people would say, given these circumstances, about their own life.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I've always been a positive, jolly, honestly, jolly person. I'm kind of, you know, I remember people would kind of talk about, well, we can hear you chuckling from down the hall because I'm also a very loud person. So, you know, that's just part of that's me, my temperament. But part of that is, you know, having the reflection that I have been lucky. I mean, there's so many things I have to be grateful for. You know, my life has been 99.99999% awesome. And this is like the 0.01% that really sucks. And, you know, but it's still awesome. You know, my life, I get so much joy out of every day. And you know, since I've been diagnosed, it's just, again, reminded me even more to just be grateful and to, you know, to really enjoy those things that give me joy. I think there are just joys in life. And you know, you gotta embrace them, right? So, you know, the luckiest man idea really came from in my last session in the class. You know, I basically came up with my own version of the luckiest man in the world speech. So this is made famous by Lou Gehrig. So Lou Gehrig, you know, famously, Lou Gehrig's disease, you know, terminal disease. He died from complications due to Lou Gehrig's disease, ALS. And, you know, that has always struck me for years since I was a kid and I first heard about that speech. And I was like, that's me. I am so lucky. No, so, you know, and I've always felt that way. You know, I'm so privileged. And of course, I feel well now. If I felt lousy, maybe I wouldn't say that. No, but, you know, even through the worst of chemotherapy and the nausea, you know, those things pass or change. And I just do feel like still that I'm the luckiest man, you know, in the world. And I'm grateful for that. So, you know, having that gratitude, I think is really important to me, at least.
Well, you are certainly someone who's making lemonade out of lemons and fertilizer out of crap, as your friend would say. Dr. Bryant Lin, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your story with us tonight.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Well, that's it for State of the Bay this week. I've been your host, Grace Wan. We want to thank all our guests and listeners this evening for being part of the conversation. Next Monday at 6, we're sitting down with two award-winning journalists who spent 5 years exposing a widespread practice of clean record agreements. Those are loopholes that let police officers erase misconduct from their records and land new jobs in law enforcement. Don't miss this eye-opening conversation. For more information about this and other State of the Bay shows, visit the State of the Bay page on KALW.org. And if you have any comments or questions about anything you heard tonight, let us know. Email us at any time at stateofthebay@KALW.org. The email inbox is always open. Tonight's show was produced by Kendra Klang and Jillian Emblad. It was engineered by David Kwan. And D Minor was our fantastic board operator. I'm Grace Wan. Good night, and thanks for listening.